mystery. Lance glances up at Sue again. She seems deep in thought, though she's probably just looking at that same house in Wiltshire and working out what she'd do with the stable block, thinking about the 20 million. Lance currently lives in a one-bedroom flat in Balham. There is an argument with his ex about buying her half of the property. He can't afford to buy her out, he can't afford to move, and she doesn't much care. He was a poor boy who bought a flat with a rich girl, which was romantic and hopeful at first, but is less fun now their only contact is letters from her dad's solicitor. For now, he is paying rent to her. That's the temporary compromise. Paying rent he can't afford to someone who doesn't need the money. To someone who, until 6 months ago, would tell him every day how much she loved him. Not so much of that in the solicitor's letters. No arm across his chest and sleepy morning kisses from Roebuck, Harrington and Lowe. Had she fallen out of love with him? Or had she never been in love? Either way, she had slept with their builder and was now dating an investment banker called Massimo. Lance's mum had loved her, everybody loved her. And so now Lance doesn't see his mum so much either. He bets they're still in touch. Balham was, at least, handy for Millbank, where Lance usually works, but it definitely wasn't handy for this ridiculous setup in Godalming, where he was seconded until this investigation was over. It was all well and good to be investigating two assassinations, but not if you have to stand all the way on the 8:21 train from Waterloo to Godalming in order to do it. And, to top it all, he is losing his hair. The superpower that had served him so well over the years, the hair that would dance over his eyes, that he would effortlessly run his hand through on dates, knowing that wherever it sprang back to, it would look great. It was on its way out. It was thinning, it was greying, it was receding, just when he was single again. Sometimes, when they let Lance have a gun, he thinks about shooting himself in the head. He should probably do some work. Lance shuts down the Rightmove property page and opens his emails. He has worked for both MI5 and 6, so he gets all sorts of rubbish. The emails were always a mix of security briefings and the results of the in-house bake-off competition held by the China desk. Sue has emailed him. She's 10 feet away through an open door, but okay. Can he check on the credentials of Dr. Carter from the mortuary the other night? Send her a report? Of course. Sue is stressed, he can see that. She is under pressure to get this whole mess cleared up. Grey men have been ghosting in and out of her office for the last few days. About the same age as Sue, he guessed, early 60s perhaps, but more male and more senior. That was still the way it went, despite what all the glossy brochures told you. Lance is aware that he is about as unsuccessful as it is possible for a 42-year-old man to be in MI5, but there was time to change that, and he should probably start now. After reading that the competition to name the MI6 canteen was won by Priya Galani from Counterterrorism, with the entry, "Would you like spies with that?" he sees an alert about a flight from Teterboro Airport in New Jersey. Lance clicks it open. Sue Reardon's reputation was high. If there was trouble, she found it, and then she would find the troublemakers making that trouble. She was hard. She could be brutal. That was what the job did to you. But this investigation had been a disaster. Two operatives shot dead in a safe house, including the chief suspect in the original investigation. No doubt that's why so many grey-haired men were in and out of Sue's office. A flight has been flagged. On the passenger list is the name Andre Richardson. The flight, on a Gulfstream G65R, takes off from Teterboro and is due to land at Farnborough Airfield on the morning of Monday the 8th. Lance closes the email, walks over to Sue's door and knocks. She looks up and closes whatever it was she'd been looking at. ASOS? Paintings of horses? Lance, flight leaving New Jersey on Sunday week under the name Andre Richardson, a known alias of Frank Andrade Jr., landing at Farnborough, not a million miles from here, not a million miles from Martin Lomax's home. So the man whose diamonds have been stolen is visiting the man they were stolen from. Agrees Lance. He is wondering if Priya Galani is still single. He has to get back out there, hair or no hair. Perhaps I should join the surveillance team for the next week, ma'am. Make sure we don't miss a trick. Good idea, Lance. They're stationed up in Andover. You okay to stay up there? A whole week away from the Balham flat. A week away from the commute and from this office. Maybe some glory and some diamonds at the end of it. Yes, ma'am, says Lance, then raises his hand to push it through his hair before thinking better of it. Chapter 41. Elizabeth is not the sentimental type, but even so, she is about to find out if her ex-husband is dead. She knows, or knew, Douglas well enough to know he wouldn't have revealed the true location of the diamonds to anybody else. Whatever false trail he laid would have been a good one. No one else knows about Locker 531. That was a secret hidden in a hole in a tree high above Cooper's Chase. If the diamonds are not in this locker, then Douglas has them. If the diamonds are there, that means Douglas hasn't been to collect them. And that means Douglas is dead. Quite the day she is having. If Douglas is alive, then he is on the run and very rich. And of course, if Douglas is alive, then he killed Poppy. He killed Poppy and he faked his own death with a corpse taken from goodness knows where. A fresh corpse, though. There was no hiding that. It wasn't like the corpse of Marcus Carmichael they had pulled from the Thames so many years ago. No one was checking Marcus Carmichael too closely. Everybody had their job to do. But Elizabeth had seen Douglas's body, seen it up close. It was very fresh indeed. So perhaps Douglas had killed two people. That's the only way he could have got away with it. So, in the grand scheme of things, Elizabeth is hoping that Douglas is dead. No offence meant, but she would rather her ex-husband was a dead thief than a living murderer. The minibus is full. Carlito, the driver, has a cigarette hanging out of his window. This is not a group who minds if you smoke, and in return, Carlito doesn't mind if you don't wear a seatbelt. The whole scene might have been from the 1970s when, if you wanted to die of lung cancer or in a road accident, then that was your choice. Joyce is quiet, which is unlike her. It's almost unnerving. At first, Elizabeth thought it was because of Poppy. Joyce and Poppy had bonded, that was for certain. Or perhaps because of Siobhan, being so close to a mother's grief. But then Elizabeth realises that the last time the two of them had been on this minibus together, Bernard had been on the back seat. Just before, Joyce and Bernard had become close. Joyce misses him, although they never talk about him. Just like they never talk about Stephen or Penny. In fact, what do she and Joyce talk about? The English countryside passes by outside the minibus window. What do you and I talk about, Joyce? Asks Elizabeth. Joyce thinks. It's been mainly murder, hasn't it, since we met? Elizabeth nods. I suppose it has. What do you think we'll talk about when there are no murders? Well, we'll find out at some point, won't we? Joyce looks out of the window again. Elizabeth doesn't like seeing her friend unhappy. What do normal people say in these situations? Here goes nothing. Would you like to talk about Bernard? Joyce turns to look at her and gives her a tiny smile. No, thank you. Joyce returns to her view and, without turning, puts her hand on Elizabeth's. Would you like to talk about Stephen? Asks Joyce. No, thank you, says Elizabeth. Joyce gives her hand a squeeze and leaves it there. Elizabeth looks down at her friendship bracelet, a very ugly thing that means the world to her. Elizabeth's life has been one of classmates and cousins, of professors, of colleagues, and of husbands. She has always found friends harder. What did friends want from you? What did they expect you to do? Her great brain hadn't worked it out. Last night, awake with Stephen at around 4 a.m, he had been showing off about some mountain or other he had climbed when he was a young man. She had then invented an even bigger mountain she had climbed, without a single Sherpa, darling. And he then upped the ante and was climbing Everest without Sherpas or oxygen, and then she was climbing Everest carrying a grand piano, and the two of them were in fits of giggles. It was love, of course, but it was also friendship. Stephen was the first person she had ever met who refused to take her seriously. Joyce doesn't take her seriously, Ibrahim doesn't take her seriously, Ron certainly doesn't take her seriously. They respect her, she thinks. They know they can rely on her. They take care of her, shudder, but they refuse to take her seriously. Who knew that was the secret all along? Now she really thinks about it. Chris and Donna don't take her seriously either. First Stephen, then the Thursday Murder Club, now Chris and Donna. Why this sudden wave of people who refuse to be taken in by her casual brilliance and brusque efficiency? She knows the answer, of course. After meeting Stephen, she took herself less seriously. The moment she had done that, a door was opened which true friends could walk through, and in they walked. She squeezes Joyce's hand back. You know, I would like to talk about Stephen. I just don't know how yet. Joyce turns away from the window and smiles at her friend. Well, the kettle is always on at mine. The minibus pulls to a stop outside Ryman's and everyone starts gathering their belongings. Carlito swivels himself in his chair. I see you back here in 3 hours. No shoplifting, no graffiti. Elizabeth stands, then ushers Joyce to the exit in front of her. As she passes, Joyce says, Before we talk about your current husband, let's find out if your ex-husband is dead. Yes, let's, says Elizabeth. That's what friends were for. The station was a 10-minute walk from Ryman's down towards the seafront. As the shops peter out, Fairhaven gets a bit grittier. They pass by the end of a road full of lock-up garages, teenagers on bicycles skidding up and down. Fairhaven in autumn is beginning to hunker down to prepare for winter. No day trippers, no tourists, everyone having to find different ways to make their money. Elizabeth knows that if you opened up all of those garages, you would find a thing or two. Should Elizabeth have told Sue Reardon about the letter? Well, yes, of course she should. That was a silly question. But Elizabeth wanted to be the one to open the locker. Sue would understand that. And if she didn't understand, then they would cross that bridge in time. Elizabeth suspected there would be a few complaints if she handed Sue a bag of diamonds. As they approached the station, they passed Le Pont Noir, which used to be the Black Bridge. Ron's son, Jason, had told them many tales of the Black Bridge. They haven't seen Jason for a while. He is dating Gordon Playfair's daughter, Karen, and is very happy by all accounts. The more love, the better, as far as Elizabeth is concerned these days. They reach Fairhaven Station. It is much as Joyce had described it. Morning rush hour has passed, but it is still lively. Everyone living their own story. Students with backpacks trying to find platforms, men in suits running for connections, preschoolers in pushchairs wailing for raisins. And standing, looking up at the station signs, a silly old spy and her friend looking for £20 million worth of diamonds stolen from the New York Mafia. Elizabeth sees the arrow pointing to left luggage lockers. Chapter 42. Ron sits on the back seat of the taxi next to his grandson Kendrick. He always asks for the same cabbie, Mark, because Mark supports West Ham and has a Vote Labour sticker in his back window. Ron has just picked Kendrick up from the station. Susie, his daughter, didn't stop because she was going on to Gatwick. Ron managed to ask her how she was, but all she managed was, "Don't worry about me," before the train started moving again and he and Kendrick waved it into the distance. Kendrick is currently hugging his backpack and looking out of each window in turn, excited at every new house, every new road sign and every new tree. "Grandad, a shop," says Kendrick. Ron looks. "You're right there, Kenny." "Call me Kendrick, Grandad," says Kendrick.
"I've always called you Kenny," says Ron. "It's quicker."
It's the same, Grandad."
"No, it's quicker," says Ron.
"It's not really, is it?"
asks Kendrick, straining forward against his seatbelt to get the taxi driver's attention.
"Not my business," says Mark. "But yeah, it's got the same number of syllables, I'm afraid, Ron."
Can't even get back up from a West Ham fan. People were so soft around kids.
"I'll call you Ken then. That's quicker."
"Just call me Kendrick, maybe. Daddy calls me Ken."
"Kendrick it is then," says Ron. Ron's son-in-law was not his favourite person in the world. Safe to say, Danny didn't have a Vote Labour sticker on the back of his BMW.
"Can I ask you a question, Grandad?"
"Far away," says Ron.
"Do you have a smart TV?"
"I don't think so," says Ron. "I doubt it. I only just got a microwave."
"You do, Ron," says Mark over his shoulder. "Your boy, Jason, brought it round for you. A friend of his had found 100 of them in a field. You were trying to sell me one."
"I do have a smart TV then," says Ron to Kendrick. "Is that good?"
"It's really good, I think," confirms Kendrick. "I've got my iPad, and I know I'm lucky because not everyone has one, but with a smart TV, we can all play Minecraft together. Do you know Minecraft, Grandad? Also, does anyone have cats where you live?"
"There's a few cats who pop in."
"Oh, I'm really happy about that."
"One of them killed a squirrel the other day and tried to bring it through my patio doors."
"Oh, no."
"Yeah, I wasn't having any of it. He was out on his ear."
Kendrick thinks about this for a while.
"But that's just cats. They're not trying to be mean. It's sad for the squirrel, though. I hope I can see squirrels. So do you know Minecraft?"
"Afraid not, son."
"That's okay, because you can learn. You get to build new worlds and create all sorts of things, and sometimes you can talk to people, but it's important to be careful. I built a castle, and it had a moat, but it didn't have a drawbridge, so no one could get in, but also no one could get out, so it was good and bad. Uncle Ibrahim can play too."
"Uncle Ibrahim's not feeling too clever at the moment," says Ron. "So go easy on him."
"Oh, that's fine. He can still play, though," says Kendrick.
"What would you like to build, Grandad?"
"What is it? Use your imagination or are there instructions?" asks Ron.
"Imagination," says Kendrick, throwing his hands into the air. Well, I don't know about imagination. Is there fighting?
You can fight, but I don't like to.
I'd build a unicorn farm, Kendrick, says Mark from the front seat, but without buildings that could bring in commercial revenue, like a farm shop.
Yeah, that's so good, says Kendrick. I'll do that, and maybe slides.
Slides and ice cream, perhaps, says Mark, and Kendrick nods vigorously.
Why don't you and Uncle Ibrahim build it, and I'll just watch, says Ron.
Kendrick nods again. It's really fun to watch too. And then you can say if you see a cat and we can stop.
Mark flicks on the indicator and turns left into the drive for Cooper's Chase.
Here we are, Kenny, home sweet home.
Kendrick looks up at Ron, one eyebrow raised, legs jiggling. He tries to look out of all the windows at once.
Do you remember Joyce? Asks Ron.
Uh-huh,
says Kendrick. She's nice.
She says she's made you a cake if you want to come and see her.
Just for me? Asks Kendrick.
So she says.
Kendrick nods his approval.
You can all have some, though. I only need one bit. Mark, you can have some too.
Love to, but I've got to pick up in Tunbridge, says Mark.
Kendrick thinks, then looks at his granddad.
I haven't got a present for Joyce, though, so I'll do a drawing. Have you got paper?
They've got paper at the shop, says Ron.
We'll go to the shop, says Kendrick.
Speed bump, says Mark, and the car bunny hops in the air.
Kendrick reaches up and puts his arms around Ron's neck.
Grandad, we're going to have a fun time.
He starts counting things off on his fingers. We can go swimming, we can go for a walk. We can see Joyce, we can say hello to everyone.
He points outside the window. Grandad, the llamas!
Ron looks at the llamas. Ian Ventham's idea when he ran the place. Not his cup of tea, but seen through a child's eyes, not without charm. If you ended up living somewhere with llamas, then perhaps not all is bad. Kendrick settles back into his seat and shakes his head in wonder.
Oh, Grandad, you're so lucky to live here.
Ron puts an arm around his grandson and looks out of the window.
You're not wrong there, kid, he thinks.
Chapter 43. The left luggage office is attended by a bored-looking teenage girl wearing headphones. Elizabeth holds up her key as she and Joyce walk past and the girl nods them through.
I don't think you should be allowed to wear headphones at work, says Elizabeth. You miss everything.
Joyce nods.
Lovely hair, though.
There are five rows of lockers, grey metal frames and chipped blue doors stacked three lockers high from floor to ceiling. Elizabeth leads Joyce to the fifth row and they begin to walk down it.
I hope it's a middle one, says Joyce. No bending or reaching.
Elizabeth stops. You're in luck, Joyce. Middle locker 531. They both look at the locker. 531 is written in sloping white numerals against the blue door. Elizabeth looks at the key. Small and flimsy, anyone could break in. The girl on reception wouldn't exactly stop you. What a place to hide £20 million.
Well, here goes nothing, says Elizabeth and slides the key into the lock.
At first, it meets resistance, so Elizabeth pulls it out and tries again. But there is resistance once again, and she frowns. She lowers her eye to the keyhole.
Lock must be damaged. Hairpin, Joyce.
Joyce searches through her bag and pulls out a hairpin. Elizabeth inserts it into the keyhole very gently, pushing, then twisting, then pushing again. The metal door swings open to reveal the fate of Douglas Middlemiss. To reveal nothing. Well, not nothing exactly. Three grey walls and a discarded crisp packet. The diamonds are gone. Elizabeth looks at Joyce. Joyce looks at Elizabeth. They are both quiet for a moment.
It's empty, says Joyce.
Up to a point, says Elizabeth and pulls out the crisp packet.
Is this good news or bad news? Says Joyce.
Elizabeth stays silent for a moment, then nods herself back into action.
Well, it's news, certainly, says Elizabeth. Time will tell whether it's good or bad. Joyce, put the crisp packet in your bag.
Joyce obediently folds the crisp packet and puts it into her bag. Elizabeth shuts the locker door and inserts the hairpin once again. She twists it until the door locks with an unconvincing click. Joyce leads the way out, and they nod to the girl on reception as they leave.
Excuse me, says the girl.
Elizabeth and Joyce turn back and the girl takes her headphones off.
A couple of things. First off, there's nothing on these headphones. I only wear them because it stops the manager of Costa coming over and chatting me up if he thinks I'm listening to something. Well, I apologise, says Elizabeth. What's the second thing?
The girl looks at Joyce.
I just wanted to say thank you for being nice about my hair. It's my first post-breakup haircut, so you've made my day.
Joyce smiles. Plenty more fish in the barrel, dear. You take my word for it. The girl smiles back and makes a head gesture towards the lockers.
I hope you found what you wanted today.
Oh, yes and no, apparently, says Joyce, and the girl slides her headphones back on.
As they leave the station, Elizabeth sends a text, then plunges into the warren of alleyways behind the station. Joyce has no idea where they are walking now, but they are certainly walking somewhere as Elizabeth leads her expertly through the back streets of Fairhaven. They take a left and then start down a small footpath. Are they headed for the police station? Why would they be headed for the police station? To give Chris and Donna a crisp packet?
Joyce rarely questions Elizabeth, but one of these days she will lose it, surely. Perhaps today is that day.
They are crossing a small park now. There are children on a climbing frame, trying to get the attention of parents looking at mobile phones. They are definitely going to the police station. Joyce is trying to remember if there are toilets there. Surely there must be. But what if they're just for prisoners? Soon, Joyce sees the police station in the distance and sitting on the stone steps outside is Donna. That must have been who the text was for. Donna pushes herself up as Elizabeth and Joyce approach. Donna gives Joyce a hug. Elizabeth waves a hug away.
Hello, dear, no time for hugs. Did you bring the light?
Donna holds up something that looks like a small pen.
What's that for? Asked Joyce.
Can you take the crisp packet out of your bag? Asked Elizabeth. Joyce knew it. There was no way Elizabeth was making her put an old crisp packet in her bag without a good reason. Joyce takes out the packet and hands it to Elizabeth. Elizabeth tears down the side of the packet, exposing the foil inside. She then flattens the foil on one of the steps. Joyce cocks her head, so Elizabeth explains.
A tradecraft, Joyce. If Douglas had wanted the locker to be empty, it would have been empty, but it wasn't.
Donna shows Joyce the light.
This is an infrared light. I used to use it when we found stolen bikes. Sometimes the owner would have invisibly marked them.
And of course, Donna doesn't have to track down stolen bikes anymore, thanks to us, says Elizabeth.
For which I've thanked you many times, says Donna.
Now she investigates murders, says Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, you think perhaps it's a sign of my gratitude that I'm standing on the steps of the police station, about to help two old ladies shine an infrared light at a crisp packet?
You know we appreciate you, dear. Now let's get to it.
Old ladies, giggles Joyce. I always find that funny. Donna kneels and switches on the light. Joyce thinks about kneeling, but really, kneeling over the age of 65 is a pipe dream, so she sits on the step above instead. Elizabeth kneels. Is there nothing she can't do? The red light plays across the foil and Joyce sees letters appear. There is clearly a sentence written on it.
"What now, Douglas?" says Elizabeth with a sigh.
Donna moves the light to the top right corner of the foil and starts to read words as she reveals them. "Elizabeth, darling," Elizabeth mutters. "Oh, darling, you. Elizabeth, darling, we both know that things are never in the first place you look. This was just an extra layer of security in case somebody else found the letter. But you know where the diamonds are, don't you? If you really think about it."
Donna stops reading and looks up at Elizabeth.
"That's it?" asks Elizabeth. "Well, then it says, from your ever-loving Douglas, and three kisses," says Donna. "But I didn't want to hear the tut if I read that out." Elizabeth gets back to her feet and reaches out a hand to help Joyce up too.
"So we still don't know if he's alive or dead," says Joyce.
"Afraid not," says Elizabeth. "But he says you know where the diamonds are," says Donna.
"Well, if he says I know, then I know," says Elizabeth. "I have some thinking to do."
Talking of thinking, something has been bothering Joyce, but she hasn't mentioned it. She had never been a spy, so what did she know? It was probably silly, but the sun was out and she was with two of her favourite people, so where was the harm?
"Didn't you think it was strange that the lock was damaged?" she says.
"Strange how?" says Elizabeth.
"Well, he gave you the key, so presumably it was working when he locked it up, and no one would have been there since. So how did the lock get damaged?"
"That's a good question," says Donna, and Joyce beams.
"It's a very good question," says Elizabeth.
"Even better, what a lovely day Joyce is having.
Donna, there was CCTV in the locker room," says Elizabeth. "You don't think you could possibly get hold of it just for the last week?"
"I could get hold of it, but I'm not going to sit through a week of CCTV footage just because Joyce has a hunch. No offence, Joyce."
"Oh, I never take offence," says Joyce. "Such an effort."
"If you can get it, Donna, Ibrahim has plenty of time on his hands at the moment and he loves to be useful."
"Okay, I'll see what I can do," says Donna. "But if there's any way we can get involved in this case, then you promise you'll let us?"
"I think that sounds fair," says Elizabeth. "Any more news of Ryan Baird?"
"Court case next week, I'll let you know."
"Are you working on anything fun?"
"Staking out a local drug dealer, Connie Johnson, nasty piece of work."
"They often are," says Elizabeth.
"And I believe we are seeing you later."
"Looking forward to it very much," says Donna.
"Any intelligence you can give us on Patrice before we meet her?" asks Elizabeth.
"She's okay," says Donna. "Bit mumsy for me." Joyce looks at her watch. They still have an hour before they have to meet the minibus. Time for an almond flour brownie and a cup of mint tea. Today was one of those days when everything was just falling into place. Perhaps she should buy a scratch card.
Chapter 44.
"They were both shot in the face, so it was a terrible mess," says Joyce.
"More Battenberg, Patrice?"
"Nowhere left to put it," says Patrice, holding up her palm. "I'm half Battenberg already."
"Murder-suicide?" asks Chris.
"Or double murder?"
"Double murder," says Ron.
"No gun left lying around, eh? Some geezers walked in..." Or woman, says Donna, and gets an approving nod from her mum.
Some geezer or some bird, granted, has just walked in and opened up. Kablamo, heads blown off. You wouldn't wish it on anyone.
More women are murdering people these days, says Joyce. If you ignore the context, it is a real sign of progress.
Donna tucks her feet up beneath her.
How was this all going then?
Upside, the look on Elizabeth's face when she realised that Patrice and Donna were mother and daughter, that she had managed to keep it secret. Elizabeth hated other people having secrets. Downside, having to watch her mum and Chris putting on a show for the Thursday Murder Club. Sitting, knees together on the sofa, touching, kissing, cooing. Donna wants them both to be happy, but she doesn't need to watch them being happy. She doesn't even particularly want to hear about them being happy. So long as they are happy, that's all she needs. And they do look happy, don't they? What if this relationship was actually going to work? What if Donna had performed a miracle?
And they'd tried before? They'd tried here? Asks Chris.
Someone tried to kill Douglas, yes, says Elizabeth. Made a rotten job of it and Poppy took his head off. May she rest in peace.
I was hoping you and Donna might come and investigate, says Joyce, but they sent Sue and Lance from MI5 instead.
Not that we would ever reveal the names of MI5 officers, Joyce, says Elizabeth.
Oh, I'm only telling Chris, says Joyce. Don't be a fusspot.
I'll just check the Official Secrets Act, Joyce, and see if that's in there.
Anyway, they're not a patch on you two, says Joyce. Sue is a bit of a cold fish, like Elizabeth, but without the warmth. But you can see she respects her.
Senior, were you, Lizzie? Asks Ron.
And then there was Lance. Balding, but quite handsome, and there was no wedding ring. Anyway, I could get his number for you, Donna.
A date with a balding spy? Well, that sounds a treat, says Donna. She had been on a date on Monday. His profile had said he was a diving instructor, which had sounded suitably alpha to Donna. Of course, she had misread the profile and so had ended up having very disappointing sex with a driving instructor. She had also made the mistake of telling her mum and Chris about it, and they had a field day. Mum had made a number of jokes about his gear stick, and Chris had said, did he look in his mirror before pulling out? Donna downs her glass of wine.
Would you like to see photographs of the crime scene? Asks Elizabeth.
Yes, please, says Chris.
I'll need something in return, says Elizabeth.
Here we go, says Chris.
We just want to know the following. One, how long have you two been dating?
None of your business, says Chris.
These photos are from every possible angle. Entry wounds, exit wounds, items disturbed in the room.
6 weeks, says Patrice.
Thank you, says Elizabeth. Two, where do you think this is going to go? I think I speak for all of us when I say that you seem an adorable couple.
Donna mimes being sick as Joyce and Ron nod. Patrice smiles.
Well, let's take it a day at a time, shall we? I enjoyed yesterday, I'm having fun today, and I'm looking forward to tomorrow.
She had given the same answer to Ibrahim when she, Donna and Chris had visited him in his sick bed before coming over. He was intently playing Minecraft with Ron's grandson, but had looked up long enough to say, theoretically, I know a thing or two about love, and that sounds like a very healthy answer.
Any gossip from you four in return? Asked Donna. Keen to change the subject, apart from three people being shot.
Well, Joyce had Gordon Playfair around for lunch one day last week, says Elizabeth. He was rebooting my Wi-Fi, says Joyce.
I bet he was, says Ron, another glass of wine down now. Photos, reminds Chris.
Elizabeth holds up her finger, then fishes into her bag. I lost my phone briefly, but Bogdan found it for me. She scrolls through her photos and passes it to Chris. Here, you two lovebirds can take a look. Chris holds the phone in front of him and angles it slightly towards Patrice. He flicks through a couple of photos, pinching the screen occasionally to enlarge details.
Professional job, says Patrice.
I was about to say that, says Chris.
Great minds think alike, says Patrice and kisses Chris on the lips.
Donna rolls her eyes and mutters, get a room, loud enough for only Joyce to hear. Joyce giggles. Donna gives her a discreet high five.
What a mess, though, says Chris.
Let me look, says Donna and holds out her hand.
She was always impatient, says Patrice. Wouldn't ride a bike with stabilisers, wouldn't wear armbands in the pool. We were in and out of A&E.
Donna takes the phone from her mum and begins to scroll through the photos. As she stares at the two bodies, the young woman and the old man, she zones out of the conversation around her. Joyce is asking about Donna as a child. Ron is asking for more wine. Her mum is asking about Gordon Playfair. Was all as it seemed in these photos? Something wasn't right. On her date with the driving instructor, he had shown her a tattoo in Chinese script on his upper arm, and she had asked him what it meant. He had had no idea. He had just liked the look of it. To try and make conversation before they had sex again and she could finally ask him to leave, Donna had taken a photo of it and put it through a translation app. It turned out that the tattoo read, "Sample text, your message goes here." Sometimes things were just for show. They only looked right. Until you changed the way you looked at them. Donna puts down the phone.
I know you'll have thought about this, but are you absolutely sure this is Douglas?
Yes, says Elizabeth, I have thought about that. Now, where are we with that CCTV?
What CCTV? Asks Chris.
There is a buzz. Somebody is at Joyce's door.
Chapter 45.
He called it ham-fisted, says Stephen. Ham-fisted.
I know, dear, says Elizabeth. It is 2:30 a.m. Many years ago, a man named Julian Lambert had written a review of one of Stephen's books, Iran, Art After the Revolution. It had not been a good review. Mean-spirited. They were rivals.
I'll knock his block off. How dare he?
Stephen slaps both palms against the hallway wall with some force. Stephen is a big man still. Elizabeth has never had to fear his physicality. Might she have to one day? Every day he slips further away.
Don't give him the satisfaction, darling, says Elizabeth.
Julian Lambert died in 2003, a hose pipe fitted to his car exhaust in the garage of a house he was renting after an expensive and self-inflicted divorce.
I'll give him more than satisfaction, says Stephen. Let's see how clever he looks on his arse, shall we? Where are my keys?
Keys to what? Wonders Elizabeth. Car keys? Long gone. Keys to the flat? Hidden many months ago. Stephen no longer has any keys. How to calm him down, though?
I've just had a rather wonderful idea, says Elizabeth. I wonder if you'd like to hear it before you head off. Don't talk me out of this, Elizabeth. Lambert has had this coming a long time.
Stephen is checking through drawers.
Damn and blast, where are my keys? Stephen has never been a vengeful man or an angry man. Never been ruled by his pride, never had those traits you see in weak men, never felt the need to prove himself at the expense of others.
I wouldn't talk you out of anything, says Elizabeth. I agree with you entirely. Anyone who insults your book insults you, and anyone who insults you insults me.
Thank you, darling, says Stephen.
It's just I was thinking you might take Bogdan with you. He could drive you up.
Stephen considers this for a moment, then nods.
He'd scare the living daylights out of Lambert, wouldn't he?
Elizabeth takes out her phone.
Ring him, dear.
It is nearly 2:30 in the morning, but Bogdan answers on the first ring.
Hello? Elizabeth?
Hello, Bogdan. Stephen wanted to ask you a favour.
Okay, hand me over, says Bogdan.
Elizabeth would love to know why Bogdan is wide awake at 2:30 in the morning. He is infuriatingly opaque. She hadn't even heard any background noises, despite her well-trained ear.
Bogdan? Is that you? Says Stephen.
Yes.
Stephen, what can I do? Says Bogdan.
There's a fella. He's in Kensington or Camden, and we need to duff him up.
Okay. Now?
Soon as you can get here.
Okay. I may be about an hour. Get some rest before, okay? Put me back to Elizabeth.
Stephen hands the phone back to Elizabeth.
Thank you, Bogdan, says Elizabeth. You are a good friend.
You are too, says Bogdan. I hope you get him back to sleep.
Thank you, darling. What are you up to?
Bits and bobs, says Bogdan.
What's that I can hear in the background? She asks.
I don't think you can hear anything, says Bogdan.
Elizabeth rolls her eyes. Night, night, Bogdan. Elizabeth leads Stephen back to bed and he is already much calmer. Bogdan does that to people. She can't persuade Stephen to undress, but she persuades him to get under the covers beside her.
You found out who shot your friends yet? He asks.
Elizabeth seizes on the change of subject.
Not yet, but I will.
She knows she already has the clue. But what is it?
Where is it?
Of course you will, says Stephen.
You always get your man.
Elizabeth smiles and kisses her husband on the cheek. I certainly got you, didn't I?
No, no, I got you, darling, says Stephen. Had it planned? From the moment I saw you.
They had met when Stephen had handed her a dropped glove outside a bookshop in an act of tactical chivalry. Elizabeth has never told him that actually she had spotted him from a distance earlier that day, sitting on a bench, looking like quite the most beautiful man she had ever seen. As she walked past the bench, she had dropped the glove on purpose. He had picked it up as she knew he would. The dropped glove, a romantic cliché no man could resist. So, yes, Elizabeth always got her man, even when they didn't know it. You should always have a plan.
He left me a note, says Elizabeth, telling me where to find the diamonds. Joyce and I followed the trail, and it just led to another note, telling me I knew where the diamonds were if only I were to think about it.
Telling you to pull your finger out?
That's the long and short of it.
How did you find the first note?
We were by a tree up in the woods and he talked about dead letter drops.
Bit obvious for you, says Stephen.
Elizabeth laughs. In retrospect. He say anything else? Anything in the note?
Shall I get it? Says Elizabeth. We can look through it together.
Yes, let's. What fun. Shall I put the kettle on?
No, you stay where you are, darling. Perhaps slip your shoes and jacket off, though. Make yourself comfortable.
Right you are, says Stephen.
Elizabeth swings her legs out of bed and walks over to her desk. Stephen's shoes fly across the room as she retrieves the photocopy of the letter and gets back into bed. She smiles at her husband, still wearing his tie. They read through the letter together, Stephen making the occasional comment of Northumbria. Remember that weekend in Rye, Mafia of all things, and My Love Always.
Well, you lost out there, Chief.
Perhaps the clue is hidden in plain sight, Elizabeth thinks. There was a very simple technique she and Douglas would use for fun. Spelling out a message with the first letter of successive sentences. They would write huge sweeping love letters to each other, where the initial letters would spell out, "Don't forget we need eggs and toilet roll." Would Douglas try so simple a trick here? For old time's sake? Surely not.
I'd say they are at the cottage in Rye, darling, says Stephen.
Wouldn't you?
Funny to mention it, otherwise.
They are not at the cottage in Rye. It was the first thing Elizabeth checked. It was bulldozed in 1995 to make way for a bypass. Elizabeth picks up the letter again and looks to see if Douglas has left her a message in the first letter of each sentence. She scans the opening paragraphs. Never doubted you for a moment, you clever thing. I knew you'd find the letter. Cards on the table. I should probably apologize for stealing the diamonds and starting this whole parade. Everyone has their price, and it turns out that mine is £20 million. 20 million, darling, just sitting there. And me a dinosaur nearing retirement. Resistance was futile. You understand, don't you? Dinosaur that I am, I still have a few tricks left in me. Elderly as I am, I still have a few years left in me too. A few years I intend not to waste. Retirement isn't for me. NICETRYDEAR. Elizabeth smiles. You win that one, Douglas. Sometimes, if she thought really hard, she could remember why she'd married him.
Darling, says Stephen, do you remember Julian Lambert? He just popped into my head.
Never heard of him, says Elizabeth.
I might put in a lunch with him. He's just had the most awful divorce. Be nice to check he's all right.
Oh, stay with me, Stephen, thinks Elizabeth. Stay with me. Stay with me. Stay with me.
Chapter 46. Joyce. I am typing quietly because I have someone in the spare room. The spare room is always made up in case Joanna comes to stay unexpectedly, which happens sometimes, if not often. Since her company took over the development on top of the hill, she has popped down a few times. She took me up to the site last time, and I had to wear a hard hat. I put it on and knocked on Elizabeth's door so she could have a good laugh at me, but she wasn't in. So I knocked on Ron's door, and fortunately he was there.
Joanna took a picture of me with Ron. I'm wearing my hard hat and he's pointing at it. It's on Facebook somewhere if you'd like to see it. I should put it on Instagram. The pillow in the spare room is one that Joanna bought me for Christmas because she said my pillows were too thin. She actually said that one pillow was too thin, but two pillows are too thick, as if that had been my plan all along. As if I had gone to British Home Stores and sorted through pillows until I found the perfect ones to annoy my daughter. There is also a white company candle in there that she bought me for Mother's Day. If I fill the spare room full of things she bought me, then she can't complain. That's the theory, at least. But she'll always find something. Last time she was down, she told me off for having the slats of my Venetian blinds angled upwards instead of downwards. That was the straw that broke the camel's hump for me. I said to her, I'd wanted to say it for ages, that I felt I could never get anything quite right, and she said, well, she felt the same, and I said that's nonsense, and asked her what she meant, and she said, well, Mum, I'm always too fat or too thin or with the wrong man or just split up with the right man, or I should wear my hair up or down, or I work too hard, or I have too many holidays, or I shouldn't have painted my kitchen that colour. That actually struck a nerve. I can be a bit like that, but I decided to dig in, so I stood my ground and said to Joanna, that's because I care. That's because I love you. And she said, so you show me you love me by telling me I'm too fat. And I said, well, I know you're happier when you're not overweight, and so I just gently tell you. And she said, perhaps she was well aware of when she was overweight, and perhaps her mum, pointing out the obvious, made her unhappy. Which was also true. So I said, well, I don't see you often enough, so I have to say everything all at once. And she said, well, is that what this is all about? That I don't see you often enough. And by that stage, we were both in an argument we had no way out of, and so I told her that I loved her unconditionally, and she said, well, of course I loved her unconditionally. I was culturally hardwired to love her unconditionally, but that sometimes she wished that I actually liked her. And I said, darling, I do like you. You don't like me. My life is too small for you. I remind you of the things you've had to change to be a success. And she said, oh, so I'm a fraud. Is that it? And I said, not at all. I was very proud of her. And she looked at me and said she was very proud of me too. And I asked, what for? And she said I was kind and wise and brave. And I said she was clever and beautiful and had achieved things I would never be capable of. And we both started crying. And then we hugged and I told her I loved her and she told me she loved me. We wiped our eyes and dusted ourselves down, and then she pulled the cord on the Venetian blinds so the slats angled downwards and went and made me a cup of tea. I am glad I had a daughter instead of a son, though. At least I see her. So we met Chris's girlfriend this evening. She is Donna's mum, if you can believe that. Anyway, she's lovely, as you might expect, and a teacher, so she's on half term. I have high hopes, but then I'm a romantic and I always have high hopes. It's much more fun that way. We were all chatting about Douglas and Poppy's deaths. Donna agrees with Elizabeth. Are we absolutely sure the body was really Douglas? I mean, I was there and I saw him and I would swear it was. But it is an interesting question. Unfortunately, it was a question that will have to wait for another day, as at that moment, my door buzzer went and it was Poppy's mum, Siobhan. She had been in Godalming. Snap, I told her, and had identified Poppy's body, which doesn't really bear thinking about. She has been there for 2 days, talking to funeral directors and HR people and lawyers, all quite complicated, and they were going to drive her home, but she asked to come here instead.
I think that because Poppy had given me her number, she knows that Poppy trusted us. And perhaps she wanted to talk to someone who Poppy trusted. She had spent a lot of time with Sue Reardon and Lance James, and perhaps she had questions that they couldn't answer. Or perhaps she didn't believe their answers. You could tell she was shattered, so we agreed to reconvene in the morning. She got a hug and kind words from everyone while I made up a hot water bottle. I can hear her tossing and turning. I don't expect she will sleep well. I forgot to ask her what she likes for breakfast, so I will head up to the shop first thing and get everything, just in case. Speaking of half term, Ron's grandson is with us for a few days. Ron's daughter, Susie, works in travel and is going to a conference in the Caribbean. If you can have a conference in the Caribbean. Her husband, Danny, he takes offence if you say Daniel, is going with her, taking a break from his busy job of no one quite knows what. He wears suits, but not ties, if that's a clue. Ron jumped at the chance of some time with Kendrick. When we last saw him, he was delightful, so one hopes he still will be. It's around about 12 that the charm wears off with boys, though most of them get it back, sooner or later. Chapter 47. Uncle Ibrahim, what's better, a monkey or a penguin?
A penguin, says Ibrahim and pats the seat next to the bed. Kendrick sits down.
Oh, okay, Grandad didn't know. Why is a penguin better than a monkey?
Ibrahim puts his paper down. Kendrick, do you know why I like you? Kendrick shakes his head.
I don't even know at all.
You ask very good questions. Not many people do.
Why don't they? Asks Kendrick.
Well, there you go again, says Ibrahim. Now, penguins are better than monkeys because penguin is a very specific term and monkey is very unspecific. If we say monkey, then different people see different things. Maybe a mandrill, maybe a little marmoset. Whereas if you say penguin, then we